Well, it certainly has been quite a busy weekend, hasn't it? And so if you're here tonight, it's because you're truly a dedicated student of intellectual fare, and certainly the fact that I would imagine, Rabbi Broyd, if you weren't the speaker today, we probably would have very few people who would have the energy to come out again after the incredible Shabbaton that we had with YU over Shabbos. On the one hand, I have to apologize to you because someone of your caliber and reputation, we would normally have a much larger crowd. But the fact that we have so many people as it is a testament to how highly you are regarded in this community. The first thing that I wanted to say is that we're very grateful to my friend Rabbi Jay Kelman and Torah in Motion for being the sponsors of Rabbi Broyd over the weekend, and we get to be the beneficiaries and be able to have Rabbi Broyd speak for us this evening. I know Rabbi Broyd for a number of years. I have the privilege of, as many of you know, I was working and living in Los Angeles, and I spent a few years in the OU Synagogue Services Office, and it seems like almost every year just about that we would have our annual winter Torah convention. We'd bring Rabbi Broyd out to do continuing education for attorneys, for lawyers, and it's called MCLE credit. I don't know what they call it here in Ontario. You have to go for continuing education. Rabbi Broyd would invariably be the go-to rabbi, legal expert, contemporary halachic issues expert that would speak always to a packed audience. It's a tremendous privilege, as I mentioned, to be able to welcome Rabbi Broyd to our shul, and Amir Tzashem will be able to do it again in the near future as a standalone event. But Rabbi Broyd is extremely prolific in his publication of tremendously rich ideas that are constantly enriching the rabbinic Jewish community with contemporary issues that are constantly cropping up anew, legal issues, issues of aguna, medical issues, and so forth, that the Jewish people, Klal Yisrael, are very, very fortunate to be able to have a great mind like Rabbi Broyd, who's a Mayan HaMisgaber. Rabbi Broyd is a professor of law and a senior fellow at the Center for the Study of Law and Religion at Emory University in Atlanta. Rabbi Broyd has Yorah Yorah, the Yadin Yadin Smicha from Yeshiva University, and is a dayan of the Beis Din of America, the largest Jewish law court in the United States, where he also served as its director. Rabbi Broyd is the founding rabbi of the Young Israel of Toco Hill Synagogue in Atlanta, and is the founder of the Atlanta Torah Mitzion Kollel. Rabbi Broyd has published more than 75 articles and book chapters on various aspects of law and religion, and the topic of his talk tonight is Innovation in Jewish Law, When Can We, Should We, Must We? Rabbi Broyd.
There's no need at all to stand for me. I'm a product of the Rebbeim who came here over the Shabbos, and it's a much better use of your time to go to YU events and support the yeshiva than it is to pass up on them and come to hear me. To the extent that I'm a product of any Torah institution, I spent 14 years learning at YU, and they were far and away the most productive 14 years of my life. It's a Torah institution profoundly worth supporting. And I tell anybody who asks me that you're much better served spending your time listening to the Torah authorities at YU than you are to me. So to the extent that you've dragged yourself out for yet another lecture, I'm very grateful, but I could well understand the choice of going to hear the leadership of Yeshiva University and not me. I probably would make that choice myself. We're going to talk today about innovation in Jewish law. Can, should, must, and when must we not? And we're going to try to paint with a very broad brush the reality that we're living it with, in the hopes of explaining certain things that are going on in our community. At the end of the day, the reality is changing. And we're not the only time that the reality has changed, but it's important to recognize that there have been periods of time where change has been very slow. Barbara Tuchman, the well-known historian, writes that a person who skipped from the year 1100 to the year 1200 would see no technological advances in that whole one century, and everything would appear absolutely normal. If you sleep now for 5 years, you're out of date. 10 years, you're woefully out of date. And 30 years, nothing works. So we're dealing with a time where the rate of technological innovation has changed dramatically. And it's not just technology. Many other things are changing constantly. And it's important to understand perhaps the most important thing that halacha confronts is the wheel is turning faster now than it previously turned. And the question of whether the Orthodox community will increase the speed with which its wheels turn to match the increased pace of technological change and religious, moral, social, ethical change remains a very important background question that we'll come back to after we're done discussing specific examples. But secular historians of change have told us with no doubt, and that which is obvious to all of us, which is the rate of change in the year 2012 is greater than the rate of change in the year 1912 or 1812 or 1712 or 1612. We're running faster as a society than we ever have. And the question of whether the halachic system is prepared to keep up the pace is a very important question that undoubtedly will lurk in the background of everything we're going to say. In my mind, innovation fits into two categories that are very different. One category of innovation is timeless rules, timely applications. The Torah gives us a set of timeless rules, but it frequently leaves out timely applications of these timeless rules, and it leaves them for the time and the place that we're living in now. This is very common. Many times the Torah gives us a rule that's easy to understand. I'll give you an obvious example. The Torah gives us a clear rule. A man may not wear a woman's garment, and a woman may not wear a man's garment. This is an obvious rule, simple to explain, easy to understand. The Torah is, sadly enough, missing what I call Appendix D. Appendix D is a list of all the garments possible and a notation of whether they're men's garments or women's garments or unigender. Now, there is no such appendix. It's not that it was there and lost. God chose not to give us such a list, and instead, take this timeless principle and apply it to your society, given the reality around you. So you can't answer the question of whether it's appropriate for a man or a woman to wear this specific garment merely by opening up a Jewish law book and studying. What you have to do is you have to go out to the street and look around and see how people are dressing. And in light of how people are dressing, you can answer questions of Jewish law. This is a classic example of a clear Torah prohibition that's intensely subjective. Those who tell you that Torah prohibitions are always objective and never subjective are flat out wrong. And I could give you 30 other examples of subjective Torah prohibitions where we understand the word of God to require that we reflect on the society around us and understand and digest it in order to answer questions of how we should conduct ourselves. So frequently the Torah gives us, Jewish law gives us, timeless principles, and we are duty-bound to make timely applications. The easiest way to do this is to look at previous generations and ask how they did it. Because precedent always serves as a reasonable guide. If you don't know what to do, ask how the people before you did it. And this is a wonderful answer. Five things, though, have happened in the last 50 years that have made the precedents from Europe in a different time and a different place less valuable to us than they were in other times and other places. And this has caused us to re-examine in a wholesale way basic rules, not to innovate new principles, but to innovate new applications of old principles. And it's important to understand these five to understand how broad and deep the challenge is. The first is Hakamat Medinat Yisrael, the reestablishment of a state under Jewish sovereignty with a hefty number of Orthodox Jews and a more general principle to traditional Jewish values has changed us in one part of the country from being just another minority group to being the dominant moral voice of society. It's posed all sorts of questions, very hard questions, complicated questions, and most significantly, novel questions. Questions about how Jews should act when they're sovereign, how Jewish soldiers should conduct themselves in the army, how to balance ritual and military needs. I'll give you just a simple question. My 21-year-old son, a unit commander of a group of snipers outside Ramallah, what they call a tough place, hard place to be a soldier, where the custom among the soldiers is you don't take off your bulletproof vest on base, because if you need it and you're not wearing it, you have bigger problems than if you're wearing it and don't need it. He calls me Erev Yom Kippur to say he's pulled sniper duty from his watchtower on the last shift on Yom Kippur, and he wants to know if he should drink. So I said, well, why do you want to drink? So he said, well, here's the obvious truth. The longer you fast, the longer your blood sugar falls, and the less good your judgment is. I knew that. And when you fasted for already 20 hours, your judgment is only three-quarters as good as it is when you've just eaten. And here I am standing in a watchtower looking through a sniper scope, contemplating killing people. Would you like me to be doing that to you on three-quarters judgment or 100% judgment? To which the answer seems obvious, but you know, when you open up a Shulchan Aruch to look for an answer to this question, you know what you see? It's not there. It's not there. There's a whole area of halacha that hasn't been discussed. It's only being discussed now, HaTorah v'HaMedina. The second challenge, it's not an Israeli challenge, but an American challenge. It's the challenge of democracy. We are living in a society where we participate as full-blown citizens. We grew up for centuries in societies where we were oppressed minorities. And we developed certain halachic doctrines in those situations. How do we want to apply them in a just democracy? How do we want to apply the prohibitions of Mesira, for example? How do we want to apply the breadth and scope of Dina de Malchus Adina? Part of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein's deep commitment in Igros Moshe is he's insistent on Dina de Malchus Adina. He writes about it regularly because he understands that part of the transition from Europe to America is the Jews to succeed in America have to become law-abiding citizens. Let me share with you an honest truth. We were not deeply loyal to the law of Hungary or Tsarist Russia or that great bastion of democracy, Poland. And we sometimes cut corners. We sometimes not only cut corners, we sometimes cut squares. Forget about the corners. And we weren't so loyal to the secular law of Poland. Who was, to be completely honest? And we're coming to America, and Rabbi Feinstein never once encounters in Igros Moshe a Dina de Malchus Adina question that he doesn't answer by saying, you must obey the law of the land. And Rabbi Soloveitchik spoke incessantly about paying taxes, and the stories about Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky are the same, and the reason why they're talking about this is because they understand this is the challenge of a democracy. The Jews were not, I promise you, faithful payers of the taxes to the czars. It's a transition to be a good citizen, and some halachic doctrines that fell by the wayside have to be reinvigorated, and some halachic doctrines have to be eviscerated, reflecting the fact that maybe something like Mesira doesn't apply in a just society, like the Aruch HaShulchan says. Another profound challenge is technology. We are living in a time and a place where technology is forcing the asking of questions that were previously never asked. Who's the mother? The birth mother or the genetic mother? This is a good question, but virtually without precedent in Chazal. You can point to a smattering of Haggadic discussion in the Rishonim, but presumably the reason why they didn't stop and address this question at great length was because this was sort of like a flying carpet. It's interesting to think about the halachic status of a flying carpet, but they didn't have one. And they didn't have any way to separate the egg mother from the birth mother either. And the use of electricity on Shabbat and Yom Tov, the use of feedback items like video cameras, all of these things pose challenges not of fundamental reexamination of principles, but taking principles that we thought we understood and applying them in new and novel ways. The principles, we hope, remain the same. The applications change all the time because as the reality changes, the outcome changes. Technology is the fastest growth area. Consider the brouhaha about brain death, meaning they were aware 1,000 years ago of brain death as a phenomenon, but it didn't bother them and it wasn't important because shortly after you were decapitated, you died. And the question of whether you died at the act of decapitation or 3 minutes later when you stopped breathing was an interesting thought question. But all it was an interesting thought question. The Rush gives one view, the Balei HaTosfos give another view. It's a very fascinating intellectual question in the medieval period, but you didn't stop and focus on it in a halacha l'maisa way, because after they decapitated a person, between that moment and the time of their death was very fast. Nowadays, you can go on the internet and watch decapitated sheep, and you can live for days and days after decapitation of sheep, and people too. So all of a sudden, we have to start asking much more profound questions. And the same thing is true, by the way, for the increased status of women. Another enormous social change. We're living in an era of radical change. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein's assertion that the rabbinic doctrine of tan du milameta varmala, it's better, a woman would rather be married than single, Rabbi Feinstein says without a moment's hesitation that in light of the increased status of women working, it's less applicable because women don't need to support themselves through a husband now, because you know what they can get? An education and then a job. It's amazing what an education and a job does to people. And so too with many other issues, with issues of women learning Torah. It might very well be that in a society where we expect women to be professionals, the kind of Torah education we need to provide for them is very different than a society where we imagine that women are staying at home. Look, I mean, I'll just discuss my life for a minute. My wife is an attorney. My sister is a radiologist. My mother is a very prominent biochemistry professor at NYU. My grandmother was one of the first lawyers admitted to the state of New York. Yet, when you compare the Torah education my father and grandfather received, my grandfather was one of the first graduates of Yeshiva University. My father is a Musbach of Chaim Berlin. My father and grandfather got much stronger Torah education to prepare them for a career than my mother and grandmother did. Maybe part of the conversation is the changing status of women is driving in a very intense way a conversation about how we want to prepare our daughters for a very complicated world, a world with very different expectations of them than the world my great-grandparents lived in. when the Ramah tells us that women need to be taught the mitzvot that are applicable to them, all of a sudden this includes all of Jewish financial law. It includes almost everything. Most mitzvot are applicable to people who go to work every day. If you stay in the kitchen and cut carrots, fewer mitzvot are applicable than if you go out to work every day. And the halachic parameters of what you need to teach a radiologist is quite broad. And by the way, there's not much difference in practical halacha between the halacha you need to teach a male radiologist and a female radiologist. I'll say that to you as well. And more generally, there's a sense that we're living in a secular society where the idea that you don't want your x-rays read by a woman radiologist sounds almost preposterous. You don't even have the, people would, I hate to say it, laugh at you. If you said it, I would laugh. And we have to figure out, by the way, how to bring half of the Orthodox community into Torah study. Presumably what you get out of Torah study is a function of the number of brains that go into it. The number of brains that go into it, we hope, has something to do with the quality of the output. That's certainly my basic orientation. And we have to re-examine the whole question of women's Torah education. And then, by the way, we have to figure out where this will lead us in women's ritual participation as well. But all of these are easy, actually, because these are all about taking timeless principles and applying them to our reality. I don't have to change the principles, and I don't want to. What's happened is something much simpler than changing the principles. What's happened is the reality has changed. And I can take our timeless principles, apply them to a different reality, and produce the same, a different result without any change. No different from the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu wore what we would commonly call a dress. And that didn't make him a sinner, I promise you. What's going on here is the principles remain constant. The input changes. Because the input changes, the output changes. And Jewish law remains normative because the principles remain the same. These are all easy cases. And the fifth example of change is Jew-Gentile relations. We're living in a time where a vast majority of Gentiles are lovers of Jews and supporters of Jews. Maybe the classical, and by the way, most are not pagans either. Maybe the classical rabbinic lack of distinction between what the Rambam calls a Nachri and a Goy and an Oved Avodah Zarah, a Gentile and a pagan, and the Ger Toshav, all of these categories need to be re-examined in light of the reality. The most significant contribution the new edition of the Rambam does is it restores the original text. Just sometimes the Rambam says Nachri, just Gentile. Sometimes the Rambam says Oved Avodah Zarah, pagan. And we lost track of these distinctions because when you looked around in Christian Europe, the Ramah didn't see any good Gentiles. Ramah didn't see any good Gentiles. I'll share with you a family joke, which maybe we'll edit out of the tape. My great-grandfather, of blessed memory, the tradition in my family was every time he went by a non-Jewish cemetery, he would turn to his children and grandchildren and say, "Look, look, over there at the cemetery, good Gentiles." Because those were the only good Gentiles he had ever seen. This is a reflection of a certain European sociology. It's not true in Atlanta, Georgia. It's not true in Atlanta, Georgia. I suspect it's not true in Toronto, Canada, either. Frequently in Atlanta, Georgia, I feel that the Gentiles are better than the Jews. But we're not going to go there right now. But we're living among righteous Gentiles, where when I lose my wallet, my non-Jewish neighbor knocks on my door and says, "Rabbi Groyd, I'm so sorry, you lost your wallet. Here it is. Here it is." And then he says to me, "I see you have kids. Maybe it's difficult. You need more money?" So I don't know how to handle these kinds of situations. I tell them, "No, I'm already employed. I have a job." But it's very complicated, this is a reality very different than the reality our great-grandparents in Europe encountered. Jew-Gentile relations are very different. This is what drove, I'm convinced, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik to adopt the view that the Meiri was correct and that we have to reclassify non-Jews and accept the Meiri's definition. Both Rav Aaron Soloveitchik and Rabbi Herzog did this. Not a change, an application of an old principle to a new reality. In these five areas, which if you stop and think about it, really encompass everything. The precedents that we have from the great halachic giants of three or four centuries ago provide us with weak rather than strong guidance. And we have to continuously examine to make sure that we're applying not just the old rules, but the right old rules to the reality around us. That's a very important principle. Without that, we run the risk of applying ancient venerated rules to the wrong situation. Ancient venerated rules to the wrong situation frequently lead to sin. Because you've got the rule right and the application wrong, and then the outcome is wrong as well. So taking the timeless principles and applying them in the historical way that they were applied to the reality that we don't have anymore is hardly a fulfillment of the obligation to make Jewish law work. To make Jewish law work, you have to, in fact, take the timeless principles and apply them to the current reality and make sure you're producing the right results. All of this, by the way, sounds incredible, but it's easy, actually. And it pales in comparison to the second challenge we confront. A much harder challenge, a challenge that's much more difficult, which is, when are we going to reconsider and re-innovate principles? A much harder challenge, a much more complicated one, and one that requires a much deeper analysis of the sources. If you think it's hard to apply the ancient timeless principles to the current reality, and that's not an easy task, wait until I tell you that the job sometimes has to be to re-examine the Talmudic sources to make sure that the ancient timely principles are still correct. And maybe we need to occasionally re-examine the principles to make sure that the principles that we're applying are themselves correct. This process goes by the ancient and well-established rabbinic term chiddush. Chiddush roughly translates as innovation, and it reflects the fact that new generations of Torah scholars come along, and they examine the old sources, and they find in the old sources what they think is the correct interpretation of the old sources, which they apply to their reality, producing new results. How does this occur? This is very hard. It's never really result-driven, but it certainly is an attempt to confront the reality of the times. Poskim see a reality that's new and novel, and they open their Talmud, and they say to themselves, what really are the rules found in the Gemara? What does Shas and the Poskim and the Rishonim say about this? And they sometimes come to conclusions that the principles that were understood by the Rishonim and the Achronim are not correct. And they innovate new principles in an attempt to better fulfill the wishes of the Almighty. Jewish law is not just about timeless principles and timely applications. It's also about innovation in the sense of chiddush. Reanalysis of the old sources in an attempt to demonstrate that the old sources, properly understood, produce a different result than the Rishonim or the Achronim or the Shulchan Aruch seem to dictate. This is, of course, much more complicated because it's an argument about what the principles really are rather than an argument about how to apply them. And I would say it's done in four ways, each of which are hard to articulate, and by the way, might not occur if you scream out, now's the time to innovate. They occur in the following category. Talmidei Chachamim re-examine basic texts to determine the correct understanding of the Talmud. They do this incrementally. They float analysis for their peers to think about, and their peers look at a new and novel analysis, and you know what they say? Sounds right. And this new and novel analysis spreads. And Torah scholars then hear a new idea, which they examine to determine if this new idea is really correct or not. And over time, centuries, decades, new ideas catch on, and this analytic approach, which is the search for truth, is very rarely result-driven. It's frequently driven by the geeky-looking guys sitting in the Beis Medrash thinking really hard. I live that life. You know, people ask me what I do. I tell my kids I play video games all day by my desk, and my older children at least realize that that's not an accurate description. I mostly sit at my desk and learn. I'm privileged to be able to learn 35, 40 hours a week at my desk. And I sit and learn. Thank God the university gives me the time to do this. And I try to learn. This process of chiddush, of innovation, comes from Talmud study. It's not for the faint of heart or those who find Aramaic to be a difficult language. It comes from time, effort, energy, and hard work. And I'm not even very good at it. And there are people who are much better at it than me. But what's going on here is new analysis of old sources. I'll give you a mundane example. In 1896, one day in Shir, Reb Chaim Mibrisk was giving Shir on Chamar Medina, on what is a non-wine-based drink that a person can use for Kiddush if there's no wine available. We know the exact day the Shir took place, because it was written in what's colloquially called the stencils. Not important, the details. And Reb Chaim comes to the conclusion that Chamar Medina, or a drink that can serve as a substitute for wine, has to be, anybody know? Alcoholic. Against the consensus of Rishonim, who had examined this issue, it's almost no Rishon says it has to be alcoholic. Reb Chaim demonstrates from a very good reading of a group of sources that there's no such thing as Chamar Medina, unless it's alcoholic, and that the Talmud is talking not about orange juice, or tea, or in Atlanta, Coca-Cola. I don't know what the comparable drink is in Toronto. It's talking about beer, or mead, or other moderately alcoholic, non-wine, non-grape-based drinks. And he advances this thesis a few times, and it catches on. And here we are a century and a half later, and you know what? Many standard halacha books tell us that if you don't have wine available, you have to use Chamar Medina, and it has to be alcoholic. It can't be tea or Coca-Cola. Has to be something with some alcohol in it. And indeed, this is a common practice that I myself observe. Sometimes there's no wine in shul, because it's a shul, and sometimes what you need to be there isn't there, and it's Shabbos morning, and we're making kiddush. I'll take Coca-Cola, and I'll mix a little scotch with it. Then I'll tell people it's a highball. And then I'll use it for kiddush if there's no wine, but I wouldn't do that without the scotch. No matter how popular a drink Coca-Cola is, the Reb Chaim's analysis is very good and persuasive. And over a century, it caught on. An insight that until him was unheard of. It is a chiddush. And although it took him a long time, this good chiddush caught on. And it's been subject to a great deal of analysis and some controversy, but it's not so controversial because a little bit of scotch, they tell me, is always a good thing. But really, it's been proven analytically to be a good insight. And this isn't the only one. We can point in the last century to many. I could point to 100 such innovations wherein Achron puts forward a new understanding of a classical Talmudic source. And this new understanding of a classical Talmudic source over decades becomes the dominant trend among halachic authorities. Many examples. I'll give you a few of them just to throw them out. Rav Moshe's analysis in the 1930s that what we call stam chalav, the milk not milked by Jews but milked by the government, fulfills the Jewish law requirements of chalav Yisrael, was absolutely not observed in 1880, and it was absolutely totally observed in 1980, reflecting Rabbi Feinstein's insight. He has a novel insight. His novel insight is supervision by the government is halachically identical to supervision by Jews. Not everybody at all agrees with this, and he's really the first to say it. But after he said it, a lot of people stopped and looked, and you know what they said? That man is correct. And Orthodox practice changed in light of this chiddush. You want to talk about a bigger chiddush? The whole idea of religious Zionism is a big chiddush. If you had asked the European Jewry in 1570, they would have said, no, 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 the three oaths recorded in the Talmud prevent us from doing this. And led by Rav Zvi Hirsch Kalischer, there was a re-examination and a reanalysis of the sugya, and we came to the conclusion that no, 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 if we can take the Holy Land, we should grab it. And religious Zionism was born, slowly, painfully. There were birth pangs, but it's a movement. It's probably the dominant movement within the Orthodox community worldwide, even if you don't sense that in Toronto. It's built on Rav Zvi Hirsch Kalischer's block-breaking work on the three oaths recorded in the Talmud. It's built around a chiddush. I won't even speak for a minute about the novel insight called Yeshiva University, but suffice it to note that the idea of a yeshiva university was quite radical and novel, and it's a blessing to our community. I'll give you more mundane. Until the time of the Gra, every single Jew out there observed the Zmanei Tefillah that we call Rabbeinu Tam Zmanim. They continued to do work on Friday until 58 and a half minutes after sunset. You would encounter Jews walking to shul Friday night holding a candle because it was dark. When it's dark, you need a candle. And they didn't think it was Shabbos because Shabbos didn't begin until what Rabbeinu Tam calls Shkia Shnia, the second sunset, which occurs 58 and a half minutes after our sunset. And the Gra writes only 14 words to explain why this is wrong. Those 14 words take over the Orthodox minhag. And now you don't see anybody who's lenient against the Gra's Zmanim. You find people who are strict for Rabbeinu Tam's Zmanim, but when the sun sets, you know what happens? All work stops. Even the hardcore Hasidic community is a full and complete observer of the Gra's Zmanim, because you read those 14 words, and you know what? He's right. And everybody who came before him, you know what they were? Wrong. The Magen Avraham was wrong, and the Taz was wrong, and the Mechaber was wrong, and the Rama was wrong, and the Balei HaTosfos were wrong. We're not sure about the Rambam because there's an ambiguity. He might have gotten it right. You're hard-pressed to find a Rishon who doesn't agree with Rabbeinu Tam after Rabbeinu Tam speaks. And from Rabbeinu Tam until the Gra, the whole Orthodox community followed Rabbeinu Tam's Zmanim Bein L'Kula Bein L'Chumra. A child born Friday, 30 minutes after our sunset, was in Europe circumcised on Friday. We look at that bris, and you know what we call that? A mila shelo bizmana. Mila done prematurely, he needs another one. We are adamant that the Gra is correct and all other views are not correct. An incredible revolution in halacha grounded in a conceptual reanalysis of a half a dozen sources that literally wipes everybody who comes before him, a list of who's who in rabbinics, crumbles in the face of the Gra. It's a chiddush. Rabbi Yehuda Felix's analysis that oaths are not one of the Chamesh Minim, done 50 years ago. I was always taught, I don't know what you were taught, I was always taught that the five grains are wheat, barley, spelt, rye, oats. Rabbi Felix tells us that it's not true. Oaths are not one of the Chamesh Minim. And he points to a Rambam and a group of other Rishonim who pretty clearly identify oats as the fifth mean as a species of barley. Oats are not a species of barley. He points to some archaeological evidence they didn't have oats. And you know what? A considerable number of Achronim believe him. And I tell people, and I'm not the only one, on a halacha l'maisa level, that if you can eat wheat or barley matzah, you can't use oats for the Chamesh Minim. You tell me that you're celiac intolerant, and if you don't eat oat matzah, you can't eat wheat or barley matzah. You know what I say? Okay, eat barley matzah, eat oat matzah, but you can't make the bracha of al-chilas matzah. Because more likely than not, it isn't. And that's a bracha of atava. You can't eat anything else. You might as well eat this. It can't hurt. But it might not help. Can't hurt, so you might as well do it. But you have your achidish, an innovation, and this innovation has caught on, and there's a wealth of achronim who accept this. Not everybody does, some don't. But the idea that you can innovate in this way is normal. I'm going to touch on, just here to mention the word polygamy, just to touch on the fact that an incredible reformation of Jewish family law took place under Chayyim Rabbeinu Gershon, which prohibited polygamy, prohibited divorce against the will of the wife, and more significantly, prohibited divorce in cases of infertility. We developed a new halachic framework for family law that frequently prevents the fulfillment of the mitzvah of pru urvu. Husband and wife can't have children. The Shulchan Aruch records that they should get divorced because it's not working for the two of them. They should try somebody else. And the Rama says that's not our practice. That's not our practice, even though it's a makom mitzvah. And by the way, we don't see yibum in our community for the same reason. For the same reason. Polygamy is also an enormous revision. Mesira, which we touched on, the Aruch HaShulchan's observation that the rules of Mesira don't apply in a just democracy. That's a very interesting chiddush, more or less unfounded in the earlier sources. The poskim's insistence that dina d'malchusadina is to be taken seriously as an element of innovation. The use of DNA in halacha. For years, I thought that the historical aguna problem had disappeared. The old-fashioned aguna problem of the disappearing husband. And I foolishly wrote in the late 90s in a book that the classical aguna problem of the disappearing husband has disappeared. And then the Beis Din of America did 11 such cases after 9/11. Husbands who went to work and never came home. And we got ourselves enmeshed in modern scientific evidence. How do you look at DNA evidence? Also an element of a chiddush, that you can have scientific evidence that rises to the level of being as dispositive as two witnesses. Our analysis of many tzniut issues, looking around at an audience of men and women sitting together, itself has caused the reanalysis of many aspects of tzniut. Without discussing the details, suffice it to note, at a different time in a different place, you would find halachic authorities who say that men and women shouldn't sit together. So much so that there are early achronim who say at a wedding where men and women sit together, you leave out the bracha, shehasimcha b'ma'ono. You know why? Because God isn't happy if men and women are sitting together. But yet, we comfortably reanalyze in light of our reality to do this. Changing reality provides the basis that forces poskim to re-examine the sources to look for a chiddush. And chiddush is without a shadow of a doubt in response to a need. It has to be humble, careful, real. When it stops being real, you've become, God forbid, conservative Judaism, where the insights are driven by the reality and not by the sources. That can't be where we are. We have to be committed to an honest textual analysis of the sources. Our chidushim have to be defendable and analytically correct, and not simply things that are convenient to say that explain the reality. And I guess I'll conclude, before I go back to the problem of the rate of change, by reading to a paragraph from Igros Moshe. Rabbi Feinstein really rightfully has the reputation of the foremost halachic authority of our time. The year is 1934. He's living in White Russia. He writes 7 tshuvot on the question of whether a woman can immerse in a mikveh wearing earplugs. The situation is despondent. The community is broke. The communists are in charge. It couldn't look much bleaker, although it turns out 10 years later it's much bleaker. But in the broad general sense, it was really rotten then. And Rabbi Feinstein was a nobody, who it's clear from the tshuvot he's fighting to get the mikveh attendants to listen to him. I know this phenomena, which is you say something and the mikveh attendant says, "Who are you?" And you say something like, "I'm a member of a Beis Din and I've written a tshuva on this topic," to which the mikveh attendant says, "I don't read Hebrew, so it doesn't matter. I'm under instructions not to do this," to which I say, "Well, okay, but I've told this woman to do this." And then you have to exert rabbinic authority just to persuade the mikveh lady to do as you wish. Rav Moshe is clearly fighting with the mikveh lady to get her to let this woman immerse in a mikveh with earplugs. It's an amazing question. Umasha kosev yididi, and that which you, my questioner, asks, how can anybody rely on my view? The questioner asks Rabbi Feinstein, it's nice that you think she can immerse in a mikveh, but who are you? How can anybody rely on your view, lemaisa, on a practical matter, ubiprat shehu neged eiz achronim, since we know it goes against achronim, greater than you authorities. Hine ani omer, here I, Rabbi Feinstein, say, have we said that there's a limit on what Torah does? God forbid, that we should only answer questions by saying it says so in this book. And when we encounter questions not found in the books, we won't answer them. When we can resolve them, it's certainly prohibited in my view to say this. Even certainly in our time, the flag of Torah will fly brightly. And every Jewish law authority has the obligation to resolve every question of Jewish law they can. Kafiya Efsherlo, as he's capable of. Bechakir Bedrisha, with questions and answers. Heytev, good ones. Bishasva Poskim, in the Gemara and in the Rishonim and in the Jewish law authorities. Bahavana Yeshara, with straight reasoning. Baraya Nechonot, and with good proof. Afshehu Din Chadash, Shalo Du Abotav Bisvarim, even if it's a novel matter that nobody's thought about. Ba'af Bedin HaNimsa Bisvarim, and even if it's a matter discussed in other Jewish law books. He has to understand what it says in the books and to rule like them. Kodim Shiora, before he rules, not after. And not to say, I saw in a book to do this and that's what you should do. Not allowed to do that. Because a person who does that, it's like a person who just recites Mishnah. Because this approach destroys the world. And even if you occasionally answer questions of Jewish law, different from the Achronim who came before you, Mabakach, who cares? We can certainly argue on the Achronim. And we can even argue with the Rishonim. So long as you have good proofs and straight reasoning. And this is what the Torah means when it says the judge has to do as his eyes see. It refers not just to what his eyes see, but it refers to the fact that he has to think. Eyes are not a metaphor for seeing. They're a metaphor for thinking. Chachamim, einehem b'rosheim. Torah scholars have eyes in their head. Let me ask you a question. As far as I can tell, dumb people have eyes in their head too. So when the rabbis mean chachamim, einehem b'rosheim, it means they process that which they see. Dumb people see what they see. Smart people process what they see. As long as you don't argue with everybody before you, an accepted view. And even in those cases, you're given the authority to fence off that ruling and distinguish that case from our case. Like all the Achronim do, who innovate new rules of Achronim Maisa. Ach ein liot gas behora. But of course, a person has to be humble. But tzarach lumnoa kesha efshar, and you should withdraw whenever you can. Avo b'makom tzarach gadol, but in the case of urgent need, b'kol shekein b'makom igun ka'uvda kazot, and certainly in a case like this, where a husband and a wife will be estranged if we don't permit her to go to mikveh, v'adai m'chuyavim, we are obligated to rule Imrak Nirolanu, even if we're not 100% sure we're correct. Since somebody's life depends on the answer, you have to go with what you think is correct, even if it's not 100% correct. And it's prohibited among those of us who say, I need to be humble. I can't answer such hard questions. Ulagain ba Israel, and to leave a Jewish woman separated from her husband. O ligro michshol b'isurim, or to allow people to sin when you can prevent them from sinning. O afrak lahafsid mamu Israel, even to cause an unnecessary financial loss. Ayin begitendaf whatever, b'avanusteinu b'avanusav shal Zachariah ben Avkulus. Where Zachariah ben Avkulus, herchiva et batenu, because he was modest, the base of Migdash was destroyed. And he quotes then a famous Maharaz Chayas, which says, the Zachariah ben Avkulus had a rationale for permitting the sacrifice of the blemished animal that the Romans had put forward. And he thought his rationale was correct, but he was embarrassed to put it forward because he was so humble and there were so many great Torah scholars around him who didn't say it. He said, mi ani. And the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, and the Maharaz Chayas says he's to blame. So Rav Moshe says you have to innovate. Because if you don't innovate in response to new circumstances, you produce bad results and our world starts to crumble. But you have to do this with a lot of hard reasoning and a great deal of thought and an element of humility. I'm not up to this task. That I can tell you for sure. But we have Jewish law authorities in our generation who are. And we need to encourage and support this and build a community that venerates this and provides power and authority to people who are prepared for a general confrontation with the complex reality we live with, who are prepared to answer questions in a timely way, reflecting the rapid rate of change in the world that we live in, and to build a Torah that's Od Yagdil Torah. If Rabbi Feinstein can tell us he's 100% sure, without a shadow of a doubt, in White Russia in 1935, that Torah can make it, where they were hungry and tired and depressed and attacked by the government that was truly besieging them. And Rabbi Feinstein says, without a doubt, we'll triumph over this because we will innovate as necessary, consistent with the Talmudic sources, to accomplish goals that make the great Talmudic rabbis smile. We, living in the relative lap of luxury, I mean, it's not perfect for all of us, and the economy hasn't been good for the last 4 or 5 years, but if you compare where we are as a community to where we were in 1934 in White Russia, we're way ahead. It's the duty of our community to support such innovation in every way they can, to support institutions that create such innovation, to support Torah scholars who press such innovation, and to insist that the wrong answers to timely questions are not to be accepted within the Orthodox community. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, thank you very much, Rabbi Breuth, for another illuminating talk. We'll take a few questions. What we'd like to do, if we can ask the questions one after another, keep them questions, no statements, you know, straight to the point, and then he'll answer them right after another. Just while you're thinking of the questions, it was mentioned on the law credits. Tomorrow, if anybody's a lawyer, even if you aren't a lawyer, but Rabbi Breuth will be giving a talk at Davies Ward and Beck on 44th floor in First Canadian Place at 12 noon on Klein perjury and Jewish law. It is accredited by the Law Society for professional credit, so if any lawyers here who want to get an extra credit, that's tomorrow afternoon. Just a little plug. And okay, any questions? And okay, just one after another if you want to line up. Is there an extra mic?
Okay, I'll hold on to that. We'll take five and then I'll try to answer them. Any more, please?
Would you say that be able to respond to the pace of change, that these kinds of examinations should happen only in response to a specific situation or question, or can they be looked at in a collective sense on a proactive basis, perhaps based on an accumulated trend?
Okay, another one, please. One more, and then I'll take a round.
Could you comment on what you call the long application of timeless principles, and I'm thinking in particular of the conversion controversy that is happening as we speak at the Buddhist world?
Okay, I'll try to answer them one at a time. Schism is always bad. Falsehood is worse. Pace of change is a very hard question. I have no idea how to honestly answer your question about how to evaluate trends. I think it's very easy to imagine a future and try to predict it, but I think there's a Yogi Berra aphorism which says it's just plain old very difficult to predict the future. So I work in a number of different fields of Torah, and I try to be a little bit ahead of the curve, but the times I've tried to be too far ahead of the curve, I'm not ahead of the curve, I'm just wasting my time. It could be a reflection of me and my own limitations and abilities, but very few people can successfully predict what's going to happen 10 or 20 years down the pike. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik liked to recount that in 1920, a naval analyst said there's going to be a war with Japan. It's going to take them 20 years to rearm. And when they do rearm, they're going to attack us at Pearl Harbor first, And they've got to do it in December because that's when sunrise is the latest. And they're going to do it on a Sunday morning because that's when the sailors come back drunk from leave. And he writes that they're going to attack us December 14th, 1941. No, 14th. And he's off by a week. Pretty impressive 20 years early. But it's so rare to be able to do that. The current environment, I feel, is very good. Nothing is perfect. I like the environment that I'm in. I'd rather live in our current environment than a different one. Could I imagine a tweak here and there? Sure. But we have magnificent Torah institutions comfortably involved in innovation. One of them came this past Shabbos at Yeshiva University. I just remarked to somebody a few days ago that if I had $10 million to give to a Jewish institution, it wouldn't be a question in my mind. I'd give it to Yeshiva University. It's the place that aims to do this. Like all other places, it's not perfect. And we could tinker a little bit here and a little bit there. But we have wonderful Mekomei Torah that are doing their best. Could we imagine it being a little bit better? Sure. Sure, I can imagine it being a little bit better, but a wholesale change is hard for me to imagine. And I think the situation is pretty good, and I know for sure it could get much worse. You asked me to speak a little bit about conversion. I guess I'll touch on it, but here's the truth. There's a fundamental dispute among the Achronim about the nature of Kabbalat HaMitzvot required for conversion. The same Rav Moshe Feinstein, who writes these wonderful words of innovation, is insistent that we shouldn't do gerus unless the ger is functionally orthodox. It's true, Rav Chaim Ozer articulates a more lenient standard, and there are other great achronim who articulated a more lenient standard, but maybe in the United States, Rabbi Feinstein's approach is correct. Maybe in Israel, a different approach is needed, reflecting not the difficulties of conversion, but the complexities of running a state. But I actually think that the standards for gerus we use in the United States are more or less 100% correct. I think that the nation-state problem is putting pressure on gerus in Israel, and to the extent that there is an undone innovation, the undone innovation is about Medinat Yisrael, and not about gerus, at least in the United States. And that's my intuition. I've done now five. I guess we'll take five more. If there's anybody else who wants to ask, please. I can't hear you. Okay. Next. Okay. I don't think I'll next one. I'll answer them all again.
What innovations do you envision on the Yehuda problem in the world today?
Another one? Great. Oh, please. Good question. You have to speak louder. I'm very sorry. Okay. I'll try to answer these. Five is the limit of my capacity to think. First of all, to the extent that you didn't like the metaphor of geeks, the truth is that I don't speak from notes, and maybe it wasn't the world's greatest word to use.
I'm quite a geek,
Okay, me too, actually. Both. No, I think that there's a mixture of urgent needs and long-term needs, and people have to examine and have a plan, both a short-term plan and a long plan. In no way, shape, or form did I intend the word geeks to be a pejorative. It was a word that was commonly used to describe me in college, and it didn't bother me at all, although the first time somebody used it to describe me around my wife was exceptionally unhappy. The Aruch HaShulchan doesn't in any way, shape, or form say anything that permits women to go with their head uncovered. This is an area that I'm quite an expert in. And the Aruch HaShulchan says no such thing. All the Aruch HaShulchan says is in a society where women don't cover their hair, you can say a davar sheba kedusha. I could stop and talk about hair covering at some length, but I'm not going to. Innovations in the Aguna problem, I think, are simpler in the sense that we have a good recipe and a good solution called the prenup, and we have to figure out how to persuade people to use it. We have to spend the next 20 years persuading people to sign prenups. We already have a good vaccine. We need to persuade people to vaccinate. Women's ritual issues, I don't know. Some of them are easy to imagine. Some of them, I think, are virtually impossible and outside the confines of a reasonable read of the sources. Some of them are politically complex because of the history of the conservative movement in the United States, but may be indigenously permissible. And there has to be a certain amount of trial and error to see what works and what doesn't work. And by the way, one of the basic purposes of Minhag Yisrael, it's Minhag Yisrael serves the purpose of weeding out options that work in theory but don't work in practice. It's important not to only work in theory. It has to actually work in practice. And Minhag Yisrael serves the purpose of saying, this doesn't work in fact, and thus we can't head down this path even though this is technically mutter. And that's a very important thing as well. I completely agree with your comments, which is sometimes the Chiddush directs that we be stricter and not more lenient. I don't think Chiddushim are only leniencies. I think Chiddushim are strictures. Sometimes a reexamination of the sources says that the conventional leniency, well understood, was wrong and it needs to stop. Reb Chaim's analysis that I started with isn't a kula, it's a chumra. It says you can't use tea or orange juice, you have to use beer. And I think there are many chidushim that are strictures, and we shouldn't run away from the truth when it's burdensome any more than we shouldn't run away from the truth when it's more lenient. If we're going to make it, it's because we're committed to living a life of truth with integrity. Either we're going to be traditional, even when it's false, because I suppose you could justify being traditional even when it's wrong. But if modern orthodoxy is to make it, it's because we're going to be rigidly truth-seeking in light of the reality around us. We're not traditional enough to make it as a traditional religion. What we have to do is we have to make it as a truth-seeking community, rigidly going where the halachic analysis takes us, bein l'kula, bein l'chumra. God will smile on the modern orthodox community if we demonstrate that we're prepared to head down the truthful path one way or another, and that's my bracha, that's in fact what happens to the community. Thank you very much, and have a good night.